Hello, everyone. I am Barbara Parmley, a very grateful member of Al-Anon. And I want to thank the committee for inviting Charlie and I here. It's kind of fun to get to go places together. And I've met a lot of real nice people, and I always enjoy just being around a bunch of people in the fellowship. I was looking at the colors, and I'm sure you didn't arrange that way, but it's really odd that the blue here matches the blue in the big book. So it was very appropriate for the hotel to use these colors for you to, for an AA, an Al-Anon convention. I'm always a little apprehensive about how do I start. It's always a little nervous, and it takes a little bit for God to take over. Barbara's still in charge because I've got all this fear. But one of the things about being invited, I don't know if this was just an AA convention, but I've always thanked AA for being, you know, allowing us to be a part of their conventions, because alcoholism is a family illness. And I read where Bill Wilson, when he addressed the first Al-Anon World Service Conference that they had in New York, and he told them, he said, you know, alcoholics don't just quit drinking, they grow away from drinking. And if you don't grow with them, they grow away from you. And so, for alcoholic sobriety, it really helps if the other party is in Al-Anon. And I'm just one of the fortunate ones that, because I married an alcoholic, it made me eligible for Al-Anon. And I'm grateful to the alcoholic. When I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, and this lady said she was grateful she was married to an alcoholic, I thought, she must be crazy. You know? But today I can say I'm grateful I'm married to an alcoholic, because we've met some wonderful people in the AA and Al-Anon fellowship. A lot of people usually ask me, where is Maysville, Arkansas? Now, if you try to call us, and you call information from Charles Parmley in Maysville, Arkansas, they'll say there's no Charles Parmley listed, because we really live in Oklahoma. But the telephone system comes out of Arkansas, and our mail at one time was delivered out of Arkansas, because we're right on the Arkansas line. And so then several years back, the states decided in order to get the right tax dollars, if you're in Okie, you're going to have to be paying taxes in Oklahoma. So they changed the area code to 918 instead of the Arkansas 501. The carrier was going to start coming out of an Oklahoma post office about 15 miles from our home. And so we were going to change our address to Oklahoma. So we decided we didn't want to change our address, because we were always have been Maysville since we moved there. So we just got us a post office box at this nearest post office, which is Maysville, Arkansas, about 3 miles from home. So if anybody tries to call us, and we've had this happen, they call and they can't find us, and it's not listed, so the operator says. And so they have called the Maysville post office a lot of times and asked, do you know a Charles Parmley? And the Maysville post office will give them our phone number. Also, we are right on the Missouri line. In fact, I was telling someone, we're not, but about 60 miles south of Joplin, Missouri. So the nearest bank is about 6 miles from our home. So we bank in Missouri. And when I used to go out of town to Tulsa, which was at that time was the biggest city with the mall, I'd go to Tulsa to shop and I'd try to write a check. And here I'd pull out my checkbook with an Arkansas address, Oklahoma driver's license, when they want to look at your driver's license, and the bank was in Missouri. So it was a little difficult to get a check written. In fact, that's how I justified to Charlie that I needed a visa.
Yeah.
You can go anywhere in the world. They may not speak any language. I've been in Germany and France and where they can't speak English, but you say visa. Yeah. Well, I'm supposed to tell a little bit what it's like. Well, I was going to tell you about Maysville. Actually, Maysville is, it's probably got about 50. And somebody said 50,000. I said, no, 50. In fact, I've read several jokes about these small towns, that the town was so small that when there's an emergency, you just have to step out on the front porch and say, yell 911. Or, our town was so small there was only one hooker in town and she's still a virgin. So anyway, that's actually, we live on a farm. We have an 85-acre farm, which is, like I say, it's out in the rural area, and we are 3 miles from Maysville, which does have a little handy stop station and the post office and a little cafe, and that's Maysville. And so anyway, that's where Charlie took me when he started his drinking career in our marriage. But as a little girl growing up, I'm from that society back when I was born in the 30s. as you can tell. And you're supposed to say, oh, no, and it makes my day, you know. I love to pull out these senior citizen discounts and they ask you, oh, you just don't look that old. And I go, oh, if they don't, I want to cry. But as a little girl growing up, that's all I can remember, wanting to hurry up and grow up so I can play house. And have one little girl, and I wanted to have a home like at our home, you know, where a father goes off to work and mother stays home and takes care of the children and cooks the meals, and every weekend we spend time with together, we do things together as a family, and daddy's always there doing things with us, building swings and just little odds and ends for the children, and it was just, you know, that's the way people were supposed to be. So I just couldn't wait to grow up and get married and play house. And so I guess when I was about the 10th grade, 9th or 10th grade, I began to kind of look at the boys. And so Dad took me to the side and talked to me. I had my sex education talk. You know, there's certain things that nice girls don't do until you get married. And you don't get married until you graduate from high school. So, he said, besides, if you do, the boys will write your name on the pool hall bathroom door. I said, that was birth control back in my era. That's what's wrong with today. There's no more pool halls. In fact, when I retired from this poultry industry where I just retired a couple of years ago, I was jokingly told him about that little deal that my dad said. I said, you know, I've always wanted to have my name in the men's restroom. Would you go in there and write on the wall in the men's restroom that Barbara's easy and put my phone number on there? But so anyway, here I am, all this frustrated teenager. I just can't wait to hurry up and graduate so I can get married and do what Daddy said I couldn't do till I got married. So I graduated in May, and I've been dating this young man. He was a nice young man, and I figured, you know, it's kind of my dad would like. He goes to church every Sunday, and they had a nice, came from a nice family, and his folks had told him the same thing that my dad told me. So we hurried up and got married so we could finally do it, and it was a big disappointment. Anticipation is greater than the realization. So here we are, getting married and starting to play house, and I wanted to hurry up and had this little girl. In fact, it was happened to be a little girl, and I could dress and play house with. But the only difference was I couldn't stay home and play house because I was supposed to work, because it'd take both of us to make this income, because he had all these hobbies that he wanted to be involved in, so he could have to use his money for these hobbies, and so I had to help with the finances. And so we I was trying to say, you know, he's supposed to be like my daddy, and so I'm trying to train him. And I loved it whenever Katie Friday night was talking about control, and of course even Jack brought that up too about control, you know. And so I'm going to fix this thing. I got to fix this guy and teach him how to play house, you know. So I'm trying to train this guy so he'll know how to play house like my daddy did. And you do these things with the family and with the children and with the mother. We're always supposed to be together and do these things. And he was always doing all these other things, getting involved in all these hobbies. In fact, somebody was talking about the race car. He was into the car races, and we were spending more money buying these little sports cars and things to go racing in than we were on our home. And I just didn't think that was right. You know, Daddy didn't do those things. Daddy's hobby was the children and the mother. So after about 14 years of marriage, and we had three children by then, and I decided, you know, I'm not going to be able to fix this guy. You know, and being the typical Al-Anon personality, if you can't fix it, you just leave it and go find something you can fix. You know, he's just not fixable. So I certainly didn't want any more children. And so, but really be trapped in this situation. And I was the type anyway that, you know, if I wasn't content with where I was or wasn't getting my way, I'd just run from it and jobs or whatever. So we got this divorce, and I wouldn't say it wasn't really a friendly divorce, but we did, you know, decide that it was just not working. And you know, I've never had a man beg me to stay when I'd file for divorces. Not that I had that many, but, you know, he just said, well, if that's what you think, and that ought to tell you something about my personality. Yeah. But anyway, we got this divorce, and so now then, I know what I want. I'm older now. I know the kind of man I want to be married to, the kind of husband I want. I want one who would want to be a father to these children and stay home and do things with the children. I wanted someone who was financially secure so I wouldn't have to work. I had always had to work since I'd been married, and I wanted to be able to stay home and play house. and I've had someone take care of me. And I wanted someone who wanted me for a hobby, you know, so we could spend some time together. And so I decided, you know, really what I was looking for was a rich sex maniac. There he stands. But he's retired now. You'll hear him tonight. But so I was working for the state of Oklahoma, and I in this smaller town about 60 or 80 miles from Tulsa, and I would write these letters to, I was working for a rehabilitation agency, and we'd write these letters to the Spartan School of Aeronautics in Tulsa regarding sending students there for training. And this Mr. Charles Parmley was the director of admissions, so I knew this name. I'd been typing these letters for several years to this Charles Parmley. So we were at a rehab conference at one time, my boss comes walking in with this young man. Like I say, this was several years ago. Charlie and I have been married 35 years this December. So this was several years ago. And my boss comes walking in with this young man. And I said, well, who is that? And they said, well, that's Charlie Parmley. Well, he's younger than I thought. That it would be from the position that he had at this company. So we sat at the same banquet table. And every time I'd look up, I'd notice he'd be looking at me. And I was eyeballing him. And so after this conference was over, or the banquet, we started visiting, and of course my first question, are you married? And he wasn't married. And the next question, do you have any children? I knew that I wouldn't be able to raise anyone else's children with three of my own, and I had a 12-year-old girl, a 10-year-old girl, and about a 2-year-old little boy. So I knew I certainly couldn't assume the responsibility of any more children. So we started visiting, and after that he said, if you ever get to Tulsa, why, give me a call. And so I managed to get to Tulsa. I had a sister living there, so I had an excuse to go. And so we started seeing each other. And I can remember one time my boss did say, though, that, I heard that Charlie may have a drinking problem. Well, now, that's another thing. I never drank. You know, my folks never had alcohol in the home. One time they had a New Year's Eve party, and they had some mixed drinks. I think I remember tasting one there, too. It's called Salty Dog. And I loved grapefruit juice. And so what little drinking I did when I was in high school, back in Oklahoma, it's dry state anyway. You weren't supposed to be drinking, so anybody could get it. And we'd go out after football games, you know. And I liked that little cherry in the bottom of a glass. I thought that was kind of good, you know. But I didn't like the alcohol. And once in a while in my first marriage, if we'd have enough money, say we would go out, because I love to dance. Still love to dance. I just can't dance as long. But I love to dance. And so we would go out, and there'd be mixed drinks then, you know. But I didn't like for anybody to get drunk. I don't mind anybody drinking, but when they get drunk, they couldn't dance. You know, they'd fall on the floor, or they'd get in a fight, or, you know. So drunks were not fun. But, drinking, I had nothing against drinking. It's just that I didn't like to drink. If I would take a drink, and pretty soon my nips get lum. and I began to get a little sleepy, you know. And I'm going to miss out on everything. And besides, you might lose control. And I could feel that. You know, I didn't like that feeling of losing control. So I never really particularly liked the effects of alcohol. Now, I could sip real slow and make it last, you know, if it just kind of diluted. In fact, I like the mixer. I love a margarita mixer. Just don't put any of that other crap in there. You know, it ruins the taste. I never really particularly liked the taste of alcohol. Plus, I certainly didn't want the effect. And so, in fact, since Charlie had gotten sober, we'd talk about that. You know, I'd say, you know, how could you stand to drink that stuff? You know, I said, it just makes me lose control. And he said, Barbara, when I take a drink, it makes me feel in control. Now, oh, man, if it made me feel that way, I'd be drinking today. But it just didn't do that for me. So I just didn't care about the alcohol. So when they told me about Charlie having a problem with alcohol, well, I saw him drink, but he was never drunk. Of course, what was it? We were talking, one of the speakers saying something about maybe I never saw him sober. But he always had this bottle with him. Wherever we'd go, he always had this bottle in the glove box called Peppermint Schnapps. Like I say, I didn't know what schnapps was. Why would I know? But he said it was a mouth freshener. And his breath always smelled good. And so we kept dating, and one time I did taste it. Finally, I thought, I've got to see what that is. You know, I was curious. So I took it and said, oh, my God, it was terrible. I said, Charlie, how can you stand that stuff? And he said, you know, that's one of the things I like about you, Barbara, that you've never said anything about my drinking. Now, oh, hey, now, if I want to catch this guy, I better not ever mention that again, and after we get married, we can straighten that out. You know. he has me, he won't need to drink. You know, I'll fill all of his needs. I'll be the perfect wife. So finally, we were getting pretty serious, and Charlie, he loved these children. He was really, in fact, all the children love him. He's just that got that personality. He has the patience, and in fact, I used to get so tickled. We would, after we got married, I'm going to get ahead of my story here. But anyway, so he loved these children. He really, you know, I could tell he was going to be a good father to the children, and they really liked him. You know, there was just something there that they felt real comfortable with Charlie. And he said, you know, in fact, after we got engaged, he said, why don't you just go ahead and quit your job and move to Tulsa, and I'll get you an apartment there, and you can stay there, and then we'll get married. And I've got some land over here on the Arkansas-Oklahoma line. And all of his relatives were from that area, and he always wanted to retire back there someday. And he said, I'll build us a home there on this farm, and I've got a friend that has a lumber yard there in Arkansas, and I can make a living for us and the family and the children, and we'll just move there, and I wouldn't have to drink so much either. So I moved to Tulsa, and we would commute. Then we got married, and we commuted every weekend to Maysville from Tulsa, which is about close to a 2-hour drive, with these three children. And wasn't long, we'd been married about 2 months, and I got pregnant. Charlie always wanted some children of his own, and of course, whatever he wanted. I would have given that man whatever he wanted. I'd have lived in a tent. That's where he said he wanted to take me. I was so crazy about him. And so I was pregnant, so we'd get in this car every weekend with these three children, a pregnant wife, and we had a little dog, and his mother, he'd moved her there too, and we would commute every weekend, go to Maysville, and Charlie's drinking. In fact, one time I said, I didn't know, that I thought it was against the law to drink and drive, and he said, oh, it's all right to drink beer. Well, now, why would I argue with Charlie? He knows everything, you know. So I didn't argue, you know, it's just that you have to stop and, you know, stop and get beer and stop and relieve the beer. But anyway, we'd make this trip back and forth, and I'd be yelling at the kids, and Charlie'd get on to me, quit yelling at the kids. I said, Charlie, they make you yell. In fact, I'd cuss every once in a while. Well, I know now why he had patience with him. He was kind of, if I'd been drinking some beer, I probably wouldn't have paid any attention to him either. But so anyway, we would every weekend we'd commute, and he would go to Arkansas and at this lumber yard and get his lumber and send me to the Missouri state line to get his case of beer, and he'd hammer and saw and drink and build this home. And I said, most people would measure their home by board feet. I would measure this one by cases of beer, six packs. So we finally said he wanted to get that house done and moved into before his baby was born, this baby we were going to have. So we finally got moved in, and then we had this little baby girl, and now everything's going to be wonderful. You know, he's got the baby he's always wanted. We are in our home, and he won't have to drink so much. So we get down on this farm, and he built it. We live in the chicken industry there, so he built some chicken houses. Now, Charlie's a real workaholic also. You know, he doesn't do just a little bit of anything. So he already had a bunch of cattle. He had land leased there and somebody taking care of him that he would always, all this time he's living in Tulsa. So he had all these cattle, and one time he was taking me around showing me the cows, and I said, well, how many cows do you have, Charlie? And he said, well, I've got 200 cows and 45 heifers, and he started breaking them all down to all these things, and so many calves and bulls. I said, Charlie, just how many of those things go moo? But so we already had all these cattle. You're supposed to take cattle if it's a whole bunch of different things. Cows are just mamas that's had babies. Now, if they haven't had a baby yet, she's a heifer. I know that part. So, in fact, he used to have a heifer was kind of ornery. She never did breed, and she would always get out over the fence, and the bulls would follow her. And then when the bulls went with her, because, you know, they wanted what she had, because she didn't have to worry about getting pregnant either. And so all the cows would get out, too, and he kept saying, if she keeps jumping over that fence and getting out like that, I'm going to get rid of her. And, you know, sure enough, he did. He called this guy that shoots them and takes them off to the butcher, and we butchered that heifer. Now, when Charlie tells me to stay home, and, you know, I don't jump over any fences. I don't get out of the yard. So here we are on this farm, and he decided, now we've got all these cattle, we got on the land at least, and plus our own land, and then, like I say, it's a poultry country in there, so we built all these poultry houses. We were raising 50,000 chickens. And then he got into the hog business because it was a good place to get rid of some of the your chickens die. Well, you can take them down and feed them to hogs because they don't see anything. And so he got a couple of them to eat just the dead chickens. And he ended up with, like I say, you don't do just a little bit. So I ended up with all these hogs. I never did ask him how many of those we had. But anyway, we had all these hogs. And so here's all this stuff going on. We got four kids, and Charlie goes off to get a pack of cigarettes, and he doesn't come home, you know, till the next day. And I would be so furious. Of course, you know, when you're married to a sex maniac, you know what he's doing. And so I wanted to know who she was. And so I would try to find him. You know, I'd try to take out. I never could find him. He'd get away from me. So I started keeping track of the mileage on our vehicles. We had two cars and two pickups. And my calendar's full of these mileage. Now, when he gets back, I'll run out there and get the mileage, and I'll know. If somebody lives 8 miles, you know, I know that's, I'll find out who lives there. Well, I didn't know that many people in the community. And I just knew two or three women, at some couples that Charlie introduced me to when we moved down there. So I knew it had to be one of those women. And what I would do, if he wouldn't be home by 11 o'clock, I'd call these ladies. Well, you know, if they answer, what do you say? Are you with my husband? You know, they might think there's something wrong with me. So I'd have to come up with some stupid thing like a recipe for a chocolate cake. Or, you know, you're always thinking, you think alcoholics have to come up with different excuses for the behavior. You should have seen some of the excuses I was trying to find out to cover myself. And I'll never forget, one time I was trying to chase him down. I got behind him, and he's going down that road, and I'm right behind him, and we're going up and down these roads, zoom, 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 and the dust is flying, and people be standing out in the yard looking like, what in the world, you know? And I finally decided I was about to run out of gas, so I better head home. So I headed home, and it was about midnight, and in our area, women shouldn't be out at midnight back in those days, you know? And I thought, how would I explain this? I was always thinking, how am I going to explain my behavior? So I did run out of gas just before I got home, and I was sitting there on the side of the highway, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, there wasn't any place to even walk. There's not that many people around there, places to get to a phone. How am I going to get home? I've left those four children at home, and I was just so worried, and pretty soon, I see a car coming. Well, then I think, well, what if it's somebody's going to rape me? I've never even been propositioned, much less raped, but you know, that runs through your head. And so I'm thinking about all this stuff, and here's this car stops behind me, and it's Charlie. And I told him, he came walking up to the car, what's the matter? And I'm going, I'd run out of gas, so he siphoned just enough to get me home. He said, now you get your little rear home. And I told God then, you know, I was always saying to God, if you just get me home this time, I'll never chase him again. Famous last words, of course. And so I did get home, and so we, like I say, these crazy things just keep happening. And the kids, we were always hunting bottles. He was hiding them out all over the farm, and I'd get my binoculars out so I could see where he's going to hide them, you know. You know, the kids would be standing there saying, Mother, what are we having for supper? I said, can't you see I'm busy? Yeah. You gotta watch. And I could see where he put one in that tree trunk, and that's when he would get away. Where he'd go down across the creek. We had this creek that ran through our place, and he'd go across the creek down to where the hogs were, and that's when he'd get away from me. So I'm watching. I've got to see which way he's going. So I know which way to chase him. And so here I'm watching, and you know, I see, he's got a bottle in that tree trunk, and and sure enough, he'd get back in there and disappear on me. And the kids, they'd go out and find these bottles everywhere. You know, they'd come running. Our kids didn't hunt Easter eggs. They just hunted bottles. So it's very lively, you know. And most Al-Anons, we love confusion and stress and all that. I think we thrive on it. Otherwise, we wouldn't have stayed there. In fact, when I heard that, I went to a meeting after I'd been in Al-Anon a while. This guy came, was an AA member, came and talked to our meeting. And he said, you know, the normal person, when they get married, and if their husband goes off after about the second or third night they're married and stays out all night and doesn't come home, she decides, you know, I don't think I want to live this way. And she packs her bags and leaves. But not Jim Al-Anon, you know. Or I'm sure it was something I did wrong. If I hadn't have done this, you know, if I had just said this or not said this, or if I'd done this different, you know, something I can do to fix this. And so, you know, we just keep on trying. You know, I don't want to give up. So, anyway, these crazy things are happening, and I'm always doing these things thinking, how am I going to explain my behavior? One time I thought, I'm going to leave before he does and make him wonder where I am all night. So I get in the car before he left that evening, and I go down the road, and I park up there on the side of the road, and I sit there. And it was about 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, and they have a lot of coon hunters in our area at night, you know, and they're going up and down the road, and I'm sure they're looking over there saying, well, isn't that Charlie Palmer's wife? And then somebody else saying, well, yeah. He said, no wonder he drinks. And I came in, and Charlie was just passed out drunk. Probably had a lovely, peaceful evening at home without anybody mouthing at him. So, you know, in fact, I had to tell him the next day what time I came home so he'd be sure and know, you know, how late I stayed out and make him really worried about me and jealous. Didn't bother him. Like I say, I've never had a man worry too much about me. So we just keep on doing these crazy things. And my sister would come to visit me from Tulsa. And one time she brought some information from their central office there, some information about AA and some information about Al-Anon. Well, now, I'd heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I've heard of alcoholism. And I'd worked for the mental state hospital there in our area for a while and in the receiving department. So I had read about they used to take out. That's where alcoholics went back in that era in the 50s for insane asylums. And so I knew that an alcoholic had to be somebody insane. And but, you know, when I read this stuff about alcoholism on this literature, it talked more like it being an illness. And I thought, well, you know, that sounds like Charlie's behavior. And so I read this piece about Al-Anon. I had never heard of Al-Anon. This was back, in fact, I started Al-Anon in 68. So this was probably about 66, 67. And I'd never heard of the word Al-Anon. We just weren't that well known at that time. And so I read this piece of literature, and it says to get off his back, and, you know, it is an illness, and all this. And I thought, you know, that doesn't make sense. I never changed anything by backing off. If I backed off, that's the same as condoning his behavior. And he'd just think it's okay, and he'd just keep on doing it worse. Not that he was getting any better by me interfering, but, you know, there's still this, there's bound to be something I can do to fix this. You know, I never, ever gave up on anything. Or if I finally did, I'd just get out. So I put it aside, and it did have a contact of a group near us then at that time at Silent Springs, Arkansas, and this lady I could contact her, and I thought, oh, I won't need that. So I tried a few other things. In fact, I finally decided that I just about had enough. I'll just get a divorce and, you know, get some of this before he drinks it all up. So I go to the bank and I take all the money out and put it in my name and go to the lawyer and tell him what a no good rascal I'm married to and I want a divorce. So I came home from this divorce and from this lawyer and I told Charlie what I'd done and, you know, he promised me he'd quit drinking if I just put the money back in the bank and drop the divorce. And that's all I wanted to hear. You know, so I caught, and I'm too embarrassed to go back to this lawyer and tell him I'm going to continue to live with this guy that I told him how bad he was. You know, they might think there's something wrong with me. So I just call him on the phone and tell him I think we're going to work it out and to drop the divorce. So, you know, I found something that works. About 6 months later, Charlie got drunk again. Well, hey, it worked once, so I'll try it again. But this time I go to another lawyer, you know, because I don't, that'd be embarrassing to go back to that same lawyer again after doing this. So I go through this same action to another lawyer, and I come home, Charlie said the magic words, I'll quit drinking. And he does. And so he stayed sober for a while, and so finally things were just not, you know, he started drinking again, and it just wasn't getting very good at all. And I could see that, you know, I was beginning to do crazier things than he was drinking. And so I knew I was going to have to do something about this situation. So I thought, well, maybe I'll try this Al-Anon, just see what it is. You know, maybe they'll probably tell me something I can do that I haven't thought of. So I go to Siloam that day and had my neighbor girl take me over there, and I met this lady. And she comes walking out smiling, and she says, I understand how you feel. No one had ever said that. My folks, when I complained about Charlie, they said, well, you know, he's not that bad. Well, they were probably afraid I was going to come home with four kids. But Charlie was all right. You know, now that I look back, I'm sure someone had been taking a movie of our home at that time. They could see this crazy woman screaming and yelling and carrying on in the drunk comes in. You know, he just says, hi, everybody, and passes out. He's not bothering anybody. And Mother's the one that's crazy. And I hear all these Alateens talking. I know, you know, they say they're more affected by the non-drinkers' actions than the alcohol. Because they understand what's wrong with the guy, with the person that's drinking. So when she says, I understand, I thought, oh my God, somebody finally understands. She says, I know the loneliness and despair that you feel. So she told me about a meeting on a Friday night that they had there at Siloam, and I should come. But then they gave me a contact of another lady that worked at a poultry company in another town there near Siloam. So I will go back through that town, and I met this lady, and she was just bouncy and coming out and smiling. Oh, man, she couldn't be married to somebody like I'm married to and look that happy. And in fact, she's my sponsor today and has been all these years. And so she said, "Now, why don't you drive from Maysville and meet me here at this town, and then you can ride to the meeting with my husband and I." So I go home and thinking, thank goodness, you know, now I'm going to go to this meeting. So Charlie and I had a little discussion between the Monday when I went to Siloam and this Friday meeting, and this time I'd had it. I thought, and I remember reading in that piece of literature, if you make a decision, stick to it. So this time I'm filing a divorce and I'm following through with it. I don't have to live this way if I don't want to. So then I go to the third lawyer, and thank goodness this was the last one because there's only three in this little town near us. I go to this third lawyer, and it was getting expensive. I spent more on lawyers than Charlie was on booze. So I file for this divorce, go through this proceeding. I come home and I tell Charlie, and this time he can't talk me out of it. So he had to move out. And so Wanda, this my friend, my sponsor today, this friend, she calls me on Friday about the meeting that night. And I said, I don't need to go to Al-Anon. I've gotten rid of my problem. You know, I filed for this divorce and Charlie has moved out. She said, no, Barbara, you know, just because you're not living with the alcoholic doesn't mean you're not carrying the scars of living with an alcoholic. They suggest that you still go to Al-Anon. Well, she just kept on and on, and she was so adamant about getting me to that meeting. Well, now, I didn't know what Al-Anon was. I thought maybe it's a membership drive or something, you know, like at Sunday school when you bring a new member, you get a star by your name or something, or like a Tupperware party, you bring so many people, you get a little gift, or I didn't know what it was. It's because she was so adamant about this meeting. And so I thought, well, she is such a nice lady, maybe I should go. So I go ahead and drive to Decatur, this other little town, and meet her, and all the way to the meeting, I'm asking her husband all these questions about Charlie. And I'm saying, you know, what I can't understand why he goes out and stays out all night and doesn't come home till the next day. You know, well, who's he with? What's he doing? And so he said, well, you know, a lot of times I'll go out, I get my bottle, I go out, I just want a drink. Well, like, see, now that's the only place they're going to get pieces, get out away from home. But I go out and I get drunk, I pass out, and I don't know where I am. I wake up and I don't know where I am, so I have to wait till daylight before I can find my way home. Well, the way our roads are around there, that's about the truth. In fact, a lot of our roads just drive through the creeks. You know, you don't drive just wherever the road, that's where, if the creek's there, you just wait till the creek goes down and you try to use it during the dry season. So anyway, I thought, well, you know, that could be what's happening to Charlie. You know, I wanted to believe that too, because he was a good person. You know, he still was taking care of us financially. Of course, I didn't know how long it was going to last, but you know, he was a wonderful father. So anyway, I go on and I prison him all these things, and I get to the meeting, and the customary thing there is when they have a new member, they go around the table and each one tell a little bit about what Al-Anon is and what it means to them. And there were about eight or nine ladies, and there weren't any gentlemen in at that time. And they all looked so nice and so happy, and man, they couldn't be living with see what I've been living with. And you know, some of those ladies, when they started talking, some of them were living in a lot worse situation than mine. And some of them, of course, weren't as bad. But then this one gal, she explained to me the illness of alcoholism, about it being a physical allergy to alcohol. And once they take that first drink, it triggers that allergy. And then they can't stop. Plus the fact that their mind becomes addicted. And so when they think about this, you know, if they're having a bad day or whatever, they think about it. And then once they know that alcohol is going to be the answer to this feeling that they have, so they take the drink, and then that starts the physical part, then they can't stop that. And I'm like, oh, that could be right. You know, that made sense. So I thought, maybe I should try a little harder, you know. And so I said, well, you know, I just filed for this divorce, so should I drop the divorce or what should I do? And they said, well, now, we don't give advice, but we just suggest that you not make any major decisions till you've come to Al-Anon, to at least six or seven, eight meetings, you know, till you can kind of get your, you know what you really want to do. So I went on home and I called Charlie and told him, I said, I think I know what our problem might be, if you'd like to come home. And so he did. Of course, naturally, he wanted to come home with the children. I don't think he was too crazy about probably being around me. I said, he never begged me to stay. I think he just didn't want to lose his farm and the children. But so he came home and I continued to go to meetings. Now, if your husband's wanting to drink and you're going to meetings, that didn't set too well with Charlie. You know, first of all, he's a little jealous, wondering what I'm doing. I'm going, leaving and coming home smiling. And besides that, you know, we never said the word alcoholic. You know, now he might be a drunk, but you don't call him an alcoholic. And he said, you know, if you're going to these meetings, people are going to think I'm an alcoholic or something. I said, well, no, you know, that may not be. And I said, and I don't have a problem with alcohol. And I said, well, Charlie, and this is what they told me to say, you know, alcohol may not be a problem to you, but it's a problem to me, so I need to go for me. And so I just kind of got off his back and tried not to pay any attention to what he was doing. And I just knew, you know, and I read those steps on the wall. It says, admit you're powerless over alcohol. Well, why should I do the step one? I'm not powerless over alcohol. I don't even like alcohol. And they said, no, Barbara, you're powerless over what alcohol will do to anyone else. Of course, today I can just say I'm powerless. And they're talking about me, my life was unmanageable. Hey, I took care of all this stuff. All these cows and calves, when they're every time Charlie'd leave, there'd be a cow getting ready, it would be calving, and we'd just be getting baby chicks in, and the sows would be pigging, and he disappears on me, you know? And so my life is not unmanageable. I'm holding all this together. And this one woman said, well, Barbara, if you were doing such a good job of it, why are you doing here? Okay. And, you know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, now, I'm not insane. I've had good jobs. I'm taking care of all these things. My children are all healthy, and I'm doing all these the right things. I've been in control. And she said, well, you know, the sanity part is just, you know, insanity is just irrational behavior. Wouldn't you say maybe some of your behavior is a little irrational? And I thought, well, I said some of the things I did to get even, and that sitting on the country road wasn't too sane. But, you know, and then turning your life and will over the care of God. You know, I'd turn my life and will over the care of Charlie. You know, that was the man, that was my God, you know. In fact, he used to tell me that when we were first going together and all, you know, that he could just take care of anything. So it was a little hard, and then I always thought, you know, I had this strange deal. I don't think a lot of us think this thing about God, he punishes you if you do wrong, you know. And I knew it when I was in about the third grade, I stole a candy bar. So I was going to hell anyway. So if you're going to hell, and I did, you know, you might, and I did a few things to get even with Charlie, which I was feeling pretty guilty about. So God didn't love me anyway, and I've already done all these things. Why, you know, why turn your life over to care of God? Is he going to punish you some more? In fact, I thought I was getting punished for those things, sticking me with this alcoholic. So anyway, after about 2 or 3 weeks of this, going to these meetings and trying to, you know, listen to what they were saying, and I thought, now things are going to get better if I change my attitude. They said, I need to change my attitude. In fact, I said, turning my life over to the care of God, what is God's will? How, you know, what do you mean turn on? What is his will? And she said, well, Barbara, you may not know what his will is, but I'll bet you know what it isn't. And I just suggest that you do the opposite of what you've ever been doing. So, and that's hard if you talk all the time. I had to learn not to talk so much. And especially at home, it's, you know, I always wanted to argue with the alcoholic, and I had to learn to bite my tongue. And, you know, so I had to start trying to do the opposite. In fact, you know, they tell us we have to act ourselves into right thinking. You know, it wasn't, you know, I couldn't think these thoughts and do it nice. I had to just stop myself and grit my teeth for a while to do it, to shut my mouth, because it's hard when you've always bounced out with all these wise words that we had. So anyway, after about 3 or 4 weeks of trying to bite my tongue and do all the right things, Charlie's drinking's getting worse. Now he's drinking around the clock. He's passing out. And, you know, it's just, you know, he's not in very good shape. And I said, you know, this program is not working. Charlie is dying because, I'm not doing anything to interfere to stop his drinking. And so it's not working. And they said, Barbara, we didn't guarantee you that Charlie's life would get better if you worked these steps. We guarantee you that your life will get better if you work these steps. So, you know, but then, of course, I can remember there was a time I was going to shoot Charlie. I was going to get rid of him. That's what drove me to Al-Anon. You know, I thought, if I can't have him, I don't want anybody else to have him. And he's getting worse, so I might as well just get rid of him. And I thought, when he comes in passed out drunk in that pickup, I'm going to run a hose around and asphyxiate him. I read about people doing that to commit suicide, and then I won't have to worry about this anymore. And that's when I called Al-Anon. So anyway, here he is. I knew I was, that was pretty sick thinking. So, you know, here he is, and this time he's just coming in passing. I finally just moved him out in a cot out in our utility room, and so I wouldn't have to see him and be around him, and he kept his bottle out in his pickup. He wouldn't even bring it back in the house anymore. He just kept it out in the pickup and hidden around a few places on the farm. And so I just let him do his thing, and he was literally, I guess, dying from the illness of alcoholism. So Of course, it wasn't long after that that Charlie finally did get into AA. Now then, oh, thank God, he's going to AA. In fact, I remember the first time we had open meeting there once a month, and they'd celebrate the alcoholic's birthdays. I'll never forget the first time I came into and they always said it in the Al-Anon side, and I saw this birthday cake there with some cake, happy birthday, John, or something like that. How juvenile. There's these adults having birthday parties like little kids, you know, with candles and things. I didn't know it was their alcoholic sobriety birthday. But anyway, going to those open meetings helped me understand again about this illness that my husband was suffering from. But anyway, so when Charlie finally started going to AA, I was going to keep track of his date. Because, see, I wanted to be sure and know when his birthday was going to be there. So I would write the count on my calendar. Well, after he started AA, he slished and sloshed around a little bit there. And so I'd have to erase that date and start another one. Finally, I just gave up, you know. I don't, that guy's never going to make it. But he's got 29 years this October. I've got 30 in May. That's the only thing better of Charlie that I got. But things started getting better in a way. At least he was sober. But you know what? It just seemed like we didn't know what to talk about. Like, Charlie couldn't stand me sober. I couldn't stand him drunk. And we had a lot of marital problems after sobriety. A lot of them we didn't talk about. It's just that we both just sold up, you know, because we didn't know what to say. And I remember when they were telling me how I had to change how I acted. And it always reminded me of when I tried to change my hairstyle. I used to have long hair, and I'd change my parts once in a while. And it was like when you want to change your hairstyle, you have to keep pushing it over this way, and the roots of your hair get real tender and sore because it's not used to going that way. And then pretty soon it gets used to that way, and it stays that way. Well, that was like me trying to work these steps and change my behavior. And, man, it was hard, and it hurt at first. And then pretty soon it's just the automatic thing to do. And pretty soon you're automatically not saying the things that you wished you could have said or back in the past. So things were getting a little better, but still yet we were both at this painful situation, it's painful stage where he's trying to change and I'm trying to change, and it was like detente there in our home. You know, if it wasn't for being involved in service, and I've heard several of you mentioned that too, you know, but using those traditions in our marriage, and it kind of, sometimes when you can't talk about anything else, you can always talk about a step or a tradition or something, kind of get some neutral territory. But, you know, we had to start learning to use those traditions in our marriage. And I remember, we'll forget the time when we finally started studying the concepts, and we'd already been in quite a while, and I came home, and we were talking about something, and Charlie said, you know, you've been disagreeing with me a lot lately, because I never, you know, after all, he's the head of the household. So I didn't always disagree unless it was very, you know, something I needed to be. I never did like controversy. So he said, you've been disagreeing with me lately. I said, well, Charlie, we've been studying the concept about the minority has a right to be heard. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to change anything. And all of you who've been in service, you know that. You know, it may not change anything, but you do have the right to be heard. And he said, well, I don't know if that's what that means or not. But anyway, things are going along here pretty good. And I'll never forget, after about 10 years sobriety, I thought, you know, this is just, we're just pretty miserable. So I thought, he's been sober long enough for me to tell him just how I feel. So one day I just about had it. So I walked into him and I said, you know what, you're the most dominating, egotistical, arrogant, blah, 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 SOB I know. And so I was waiting for this reply. In fact, I was about ready to dodge, you know, and he comes walking in behind me and he said, well, Barbara, if I'm that bad, why do you live with me? Well, I thought about that a minute, and why would somebody live with somebody like that? I mean, if you're sane, and I was getting more sane by then, and I thought about that for me, I thought, that's exactly the kind of guy I want. That's exactly what I need. I don't need somebody I can push around and control and take, you know. So, you know, when you've got what you want, I've been happy ever since. In fact, I remember him telling that now and on, if you haven't got what you want, you take what you've got and make it into what you want. Well, I've been trying to make him into what I want, and he's not fixed, you know, I couldn't fix this guy. And finally I decided, I have exactly what I want. You know, I've got a man that takes care of his family and his children. You know, he's always said, you women want us to take care of everything, but then you want to start telling us how to do it. So I had to back off. I'll never forget the time. Oh, I was so angry at him because you know, I thought he ought to be doing some stuff out here in the yard. I have to take care of the house. I have to go outside and take care of the yard. He never wants to mow the yard. So I'm out there, this before we had the riding mower, and I'm pushing this lawnmower. And it was a paramour, but I had to push it. And I'm thinking, he's been taking a nap on the couch. Of course, he had been mowing hay that day, but that's not like working out in the yard. But anyway, you know, I'm thinking, just because he worked a few hours after, he comes in and sleeps all the rest of the day, and I'm out here still working, because I finally got a job and went to work after we got married. But I'm thinking, as soon as I get through mowing this grass, I'm going to get a divorce. I've had it. You know, I'm always going to get a divorce. Can you remember those first few years of sobriety? You know, I'm always, every day I'm going to get a divorce. And so I'm getting a divorce. As soon as I get through mowing this yard Monday, I'm going down, I'm getting a divorce. And I just keep pushing that thing, you know, why have a man if I'm going to have to do all this, blah, 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 blah. And finally this voice saying, Barbara, if you get a divorce, who's going to mow the yard? I'd still be mowing the yard. So why would a divorce do me? You know, in fact, after I just got into Al-Anon, and I tell you, staying home with four kids, I always wanted to stay home and play house and be a mommy. Hey, after staying home with four kids, I would have paid somebody to let me come get a job. That being a homemaker, and you don't get paid very much. Have you ever had your husband walk in and say, oh, honey, the toilet stool just looks pretty beautiful today, you know, or the kitchen cabinet looks nice and shiny, you know? At least at work, I got compliments, and I got some ego building there. And besides, somewhere else, Charlie did give me a pretty good allowance, but anyway, so I finally said, I got to get off this farm. And besides all these cows and hogs and chickens and stuff, and four kids, it was working me to death. And like I say, he didn't pay all that good. So finally, I asked him about getting a job, and he said, well, if that's what you really want to do. So I did get the job. In our area, I mean, whenever it snows and the highways are all covered with snow and you can't get to work, hey, I would rather get stuck on the highway in the snow and stay home with those four kids when they weren't going to school. But I finally got a job with this poultry company. That was in 69. And I'll tell you, I learned something. I finally learned consistency. I'm a very inconsistent person. Charlie and I are very opposite. He's very consistent. He never changes anything. If he says he's going to do something, he does it. If he says he's not, hey, you're not going to change his mind. I am inconsistent. I may do it this way time, and this time I'll do it this way, and I don't even know how I'm going to do it the next time. But since I've been in Allen, I've learned a little bit more consistency, and I had that same job. I retired 2 years ago, finally, after starting in 69, working for this poultry company. I've had the same husband for 35 years. Like Charlie says, he refers to me, and we've referred each other. He's my current husband. You know, he said, we can be replaced any time. But, you know, I can't believe, you know, the personality change that we get when we get in here. But so things are going along pretty good, and I got this job finally, and the other children are growing up, and they're going off to college, and our son was about 2 when we got married. When he was 15, he decided he wanted to go live with his own father because there's things there he could do, and we would get him a motorcycle and all these things that he could have, and living in the city and not out on this farm. And so he went to live with his father when he was 15, and I'll never forget having to let that little boy go, you know. And I could tell he felt bad about wanting to leave and go with, and there's so many of us now with marriages where our children are, you know, we've got 2 or 3 kids from other marriages and all this together. And I knew it was hard for that boy to make that decision, and I didn't want to make him feel any more guilt than he was feeling. So, and I know if I'd been 15 and I'd been offered all these things, and the freedom and the motorcycles and the wear the long hair, because we had some rules in our home. And so, you know, I said, son, I don't mind you, you know, I could understand you doing that. And it just darn near broke Charlie's heart, because he practically raised this boy from a baby. So we had to let him go. Well, about then, the daughter, we refer to her as the prodigal daughter, she was probably about 12, 13, and of course, when we first got into Al-Anon, they started talking about the heredity part. They'd done all these studies, so I thought, well, now, if she's inherited this physical allergy, if she ever takes a drink, she could be an alcoholic. So I talked to her about that one time. I said, honey, don't ever mess with that stuff, because you could be, you know, you could have this physical allergy, and I don't think I could watch another person dying from alcoholism. So she's old, mother, if I ever drank like daddy, I wouldn't drink, I'd quit. And I think she was about 3 when he quit. But we've drugged those kids around, and the 2 young ones around all these open meetings and conventions and things. So they thought they couldn't wait to grow up to be an alcoholic. All we do is laugh and have fun. You know, we'd have meetings in our homes and stuff, and everybody was always happy. And I never forget when the son wanted to hurry up and grow up and be an alcoholic like Charlie. You know, he wanted to start going to meetings. I never forget when he first started trying to smoke a cigarette. I caught him out there smoking butts when they'd throw him on the ground trying trying to smoke. And then there's a few things he kind of started picking up, and Charlie was teaching him how to drive his pickup, so they go out and feed the cattle. And so one night we were taking him off to the babysitters, going to our meetings, and Kurt leans back and he said, "Well, Dad, now when do I get to start going to meetings with you?" Well, he's supposed to grow up and be like Dad. But so in here's this Charlotte, who is our prodigal daughter. I refer to her today. She's 32 years old, but this was back when she was this little girl growing up, and I'm going to fix her. Now, I know what causes alcoholism, so I'm going to fix her so she won't have to drink. I've heard alcoholics talk. The reason they drink is because they don't feel like they fit. You know, they're not comfortable. So when they take that drink, they feel good. Well, if I can just make her feel good all the time, she won't have to take a drink to do that. So we just let her, you know, she's the baby anyway. You just give her everything she wants, and we've kind of spoiled her a little bit. Well, she's the apple of her daddy's eye anyway. So, you know, this kid will never have to drink to fit. She's sharp. She made good grades in school. She could just do anything. Well, when she was about 14, I was planting some tomato seeds in a little pot, getting ready for the garden that year. And she says, "Mom, can I have some seeds? I want to put some plants in my window too." Well, when her plants came up, they weren't like mine. And so I said, "I don't know what that is. If it's what I think it is, get it out of this house, or you're going to be in trouble." And Carol Burnett had just come out with her deal then about them. You know what's going on. You know, have you looked in your children's room? So I went in her room, and you know how you're going in a teenager's room. You don't dare. I just always shut the door. When they leave home, then I'll go in and clean it out. So I opened up the door, and I went in and I looked around some drawers. And I found little pipe things and all kinds of notes that she and her girlfriend were writing back and forth. And some of these things, the girls were a lot, they're so much more promiscuous today than they were back in my day. And so all these things, oh my God. And she was, her grades were beginning to go down. I quit my job at the poultry plant so I could start substituting at school and keep track of her. You know, I got to find out what she's doing. I got to stop this. Got to fix it. And in fact, one time I was substituting in a class where they had her marked present on a weekend that I knew she was gone because we'd taken her out to go to a convention in Arkansas, and they had her marked there. So I went into the secretary's office at the school, and I said, "How come Charlotte's marked here today? I remember taking her out." Just, "Oh, well, we must have just made a mistake." But you know what? That kid could con anyone. You know, she had this personality. She still does. She's just the sweetest one. You know, she's just a precious little gal, and she's sharp enough. No telling what she told him, you know. But anyway, they didn't mark her absence, and so no telling. She had been skipping school quite a bit. So finally, I'd quit my job, and I was watching her real close, and so she was getting angrier, more angry. I'm building this wall between us because I'm doing just like with the alcoholic. You know, I'm obsessed with her, and I could see what I was doing, and finally it dawned on me, "Barbara, you've got to back off." So I was taking her down to catch the bus one morning, and I said, "Charlotte, I'm not going back in your room anymore. I'm not going to watch you do any, you know, I'm going to back off and let you do what you think's necessary for you to do, honey. Maybe there's some things you're going to have to do like your dad, and hopefully you'll come out of it okay. And maybe there's something, you know, there's maybe a reason down the road for you to go through this." So anyway, I backed off, and then that summer I went in to call for breakfast one morning, and she was gone. Well, first thing, I opened her room and it was clean. I knew something was wrong, and we, you know, she was gone. No note, nothing. So we went down and tried to talk to find some of her friends that they knew where she was, and nobody did. So we went through the proper authorities to find her. And she was about 15 then. And she had become a ward of the court for them to start looking for her. Well, they finally found her about a week later in Tulsa. But during this time, I am so angry at God. You know, I've done everything that they told me to do in this program. I worked all these steps. I went in service. I was in Arkansas to be anything. If you have to, in fact, the year I was delegate, you've got to go visit. You're supposed to visit these groups. You can't even drive across Arkansas unless you take a ferry. You know, it's just such a crazy state with the mountains and things around it. And here, you know, I had done everything they asked me to do, and this is my reward. And I remember saying that to her. I said, "Is this our reward for doing all these things?" And he said, "Well, Barbara, God doesn't reward, you know, and he doesn't punish. You do good, you feel good. You do bad, you feel bad. But God doesn't reward or punish." And so, but I was still, you know, I was just the hurt and the pain. I always said, if anything ever happened to one of my children, you just might as well bury me with them, because I don't think I could stand the loss. Because I was really obsessed with my children. My mother left me when I was about third or fourth grade. And I always vowed that my children will always know that they're the most important thing in my life. And today, you know, in fact, this daughter, she's very lenient with her daughter, because she said, "I was so obsessed with my children. You know, I never let them go anywhere when they got out of school. I want them home with me. so I could see them. You know, you're mine. I want you to know how important you are to me. So I just kept that thumb on them. And so, you know, and here we didn't know where she was, and I'm angry, and it's like, you know, I'm saying, why me, God? Why? And this voice said, well, why not you, Barbara? What makes you think you're different? You know, a lot of other people have got to go through this. Why not you? And so these things just kind of kept going. And then there's page one of our ODAT book. It says, you know, if the crisis happens, you keep on doing what you'd be doing if the crisis hadn't happened. So I kept on trying to do the things I should be doing and going to my meetings. And of course, you get a lot of support from the members in our fellowship. And finally, we did get a call, and they picked her up, and I had to go get her in Tulsa. And she stayed a ward of the court. She didn't want to come home. She didn't want to come home and obey the rules of our home, which weren't that strict, but there were just certain things that you couldn't do. You couldn't drink and grow pot, you know, and there were certain hours you had to come in by, and just certain things that you weren't going to be able to do. So she became a ward of the court, and she kind of misbehaved there a few times and was put in and out of some institutions, and one of them was called Raider Center, which is like a reform school. I mean, it was like a prison. I'd never been in such a place. And I went to visit her, and she just was smiling and all. I said, Charlotte, what are you doing here all this time? What do you do during your day? She says, oh, I tutor a lot of the students. And she didn't seem to mind, you know. And I'd come home here crying and telling Charlie, I said, you help all these other alcoholics and doing all this stuff. Why can't you do something for our child? And he said, Barbara, she doesn't want help. And, of course, most of you are in here. You know, your children or family are the last ones you can help. So, you know, I just had to know that whatever, you know, she's God's child. There's not a thing I can do. If you know, if he sees fit to take her today, then it's, you know, if he wants her there, then that's where she's going to go. And if not, then there's some lessons she's going to have to learn. So finally, she got out of all that mess, and she did. She went off to Tahoe. In fact, we went to the courts again and got custody. And so we got out of that hearing, and Charlie said, Charlotte, what do you want to do? And she said, I just want to be free. I said, Charlotte, you've been trying to be free for 2 years, and you've been locked up. And so Charlie said, Charlotte, if that's what you want, I think she was 16 then, said, you just go ahead and you do what you think you want to do, but you call us every week and let us know you're okay, or the courts will you know, take you back again. You'll have to become a ward of the court. So she takes off to Tahoe and lives out there about a year with a friend, and she called us then when she was about 17 and said, Mom, I think I've done everything I want to do. I want to come home. And so she came home. Charlie sent her bus or airfare, and she came home and got a job, same poultry company where I was working, and got her GED, and got married, and had a little tragedy in her first marriage. Her husband had committed suicide. I don't know if they were doing drugs or what the deal was then. I tried not to pay any attention. Boy, it's hard when they're living close to not to stay out of their business. Thank God we have Al-Anon, you know, to know that we're powerless. You know, every day I have to work that first step. I am powerless over these people I love. And, you know, I can't carry her over the bridge. You know, when I looked at this, every time I see that, I thought, you know, I think that's what most Al-Anons try to do. We want to carry them over the bridge, especially your children. After all, when they told me I had to turn that child loose and detach, I said, hey, you know, nature gives mothers an instinct to take care of this young. I watch those mama cows. Hey, they never leave that cow, that calf. They stay right there, and you get near them, and boy, they'll run you off, you know. And so, you know, that God has given mothers a natural instinct to take care of their children. And yet in Al-Anon, they were telling me I had to, you know, detach and let her go and die or whatever it is she needs to do. And there's a lot of us who've lost children. My sponsor that I started, my sponsor today, she had two sons. She had four children, but two of her sons committed suicide from some problems they had within 6 months of each other when they were older. And she was able to cope with that, you know. So thank God that didn't happen to me. But this, you know, trying to carry our children, our loved ones, over this bridge, and now, of course, some of these grandchildren are coming into the fellowship. You know, you stay in long enough, you see all these generations. You know, maybe someday that's the answer to our world peace. Yeah, how many of you ever got to go to the International and see all these countries that walk through and carrying that flag of their country, and that they're saying the same thing you and I are saying? You know, I may not like all of you, but I've learned to love you in your own special way. There's some of us are crazy, you know. You know, I wouldn't have picked to be a friend of you for anything. But when you're in my group, you're there. We still have the same feelings. Now, you may react to yours different than I do. But, you know, we got this one thing in common, you know, and that's what we talk about in the fellowship, is what we've got in common, not what we've got different. I don't care about your lifestyle, your your income or whatever, you know, it's what we have in common, which is the pain. Pain is pain. You know, you can either get hit on the head with a hammer or hit on the head with a ball, baseball bat. The pain's the same. And so how do I recover from this pain? And so today, you know, with this daughter, after I retired, this daughter was promoted to my position in management at this poultry company. You know, it's just some of the good things that happened. She had a little girl. We've got 13 grandchildren and one great-grandchild. Now, I know you don't know how that would happen. I've got one daughter that's the same age I am, and how that happened, I don't know, you know. So here we got this one, but they're scattered around. We have some live in Missouri and some in Kansas and some in Colorado, and then we have Charlotte. The one, I said, Charlotte, you've always done everything backwards. You run away when you're supposed to be home. Then you come home when you're supposed to be gone, you know. So she lives right there by us, and she has this little girl that's 8 years old today, and it's like I've got a second chance to play mommy. You know, God gives it to you when you're ready for it. Today, I've got the patience. You know, I'm not always young, and I've watched my children. Hey, listen, we teach by bad example. My daughters are the best mothers. My son's the best father. They have more patience with their children, whatever their kids want to do, and they're always involved in all these things with them. I had a lot of guilt because of the things I denied my children because I was so wrapped up in the alcoholic. You know, that was the primary thing in my life, was watching this drunk, not my kid. And just don't bother me while I watch him. And so I've watched these children, and the guilt I had, every once in a while I'll send some money to one of them, just or a gift or something, and they'll say, Mom, what's that for? And I said, oh, that's for babysitting. You know, we got to go into so many meetings after sobriety. We were going 4 or 5 meetings. We were the only one around at that time was in Siloam, which is about 30 minutes from our place. You don't give mileage in our area because it's so crooked. You just say how long it takes to get there, 30 minutes. And so we started some little groups around so we didn't have to drive so far because everybody had to drive in there. So we started some groups over in Oklahoma on the corner. And in fact, I go to 3 meetings a week and to 2 meetings in Missouri here. So we're starting all these meetings. We're going every night. And I'm saying, Charlie, I feel so guilty leaving these kids all the time. He said, well, Barbara, what kind of parents would we be if we weren't going to meetings? You know, and it's like, and there was a time when the son got married. And so he told, Charlie said, now these are the weekends I'll be home so we can plan your wedding. Because he got real involved in a lot of his travels, which some of you know. And so they couldn't get to church on that weekend. So Charlie couldn't be there. And boy, my sister was very upset, you know. I suppose if one of them died and he was going to an AA meeting, he couldn't come to the funeral. And one of the kids overheard her say that. And she said, well, you know, Aunt Connie, funerals and weddings and all these other things never kept our daddy sober. But AA does. You know, AA has to be first. I used to envy you. I used to be a little jealous, you know, because I thought I wish I were an alcoholic so he'd talk to me. You know, we just don't communicate that much sometimes. I want to know his feelings. And he never told me how he felt, except when he was pissed off at me about something. You know, excuse me, that's on the tape. But anyway, you know, I get lectures, you know, if I don't check the oil in the mower or something. But anyway, I had to realize, you know, that AA is what keeps Charlie what he is. And I want him to be sober. I want that to be number one in his life. If that's number one, I've got a good husband, a thoughtful husband. The children have a good father. You know, he's a good... he's just a good man when he's sober, and AA keeps him that way. So I am so grateful that he put AA first. You know, and it also had to come the same way for me in Al-Anon. It has to be first. There's been times when I'd get, you know, an ego thing in my job, too busy to go to a meeting, or something else would be happening. Charlie had his heart attack, and I really was trying to take care of all that, you know, and I was going crazy, and I'm saying, oh, God, you know, what am I going to do? And this voice, I'm always hearing voices. I don't know about the rest of you. Ken last night was talking about hearing things, you know. I get these things, and I was like, Barbara, what are you putting first now? What's happening here? And I'm like, oh, you know, you put Al-Anon first. You get to those meetings where you get plugged in to the power, and that's where the power is when you go to meetings. That's where God is. You know, you don't go to a church to find God, or you find God in people, and that's where He is. So I go to my meetings. I get plugged in and get the power to help me cope with the world out here. You know, when they told me that I'd come in here and everything was going to get, my life was going to get better, it didn't mean that God's going to change the world. It just meant He was going to give me the power. That's what a spiritual awakening was. He's going to give me the strength and the power to cope with what's out here with some type of serenity. Today, you know, it couldn't be any better. You know, thank goodness, you know, say our children are healthy today. And Charlie and I have a wonderful marriage. I didn't know how it was going to work out when I retired because we had a perfect marriage. I worked all week, and he traveled every weekend. And we just couldn't wait to see each other. You know, it was really wonderful when we get together. So, and as it's obvious, I'd like to talk. And so I thought, I'll get on his nerves. He'll be in my way when I want to do this at the house, and how are we going to do this? And so I was really apprehensive about this retirement of us being home because he's been retired for several years. So I was able to pick up an extra meeting, so I'm getting 3 meetings a week, which helps. And, of course, Charlie goes to 3 or 4 meetings at home and his groups. And so things have, you know, we kind of broke off our territory. What we did in our marriage to make it so we wouldn't have to argue about it, anything we started having a controversy over, we worked it out. Charlie believes in saving money. I believe in spending money. You know, he always said, how much money have you got saved, Barbara? I said, Charlie, I don't work to save it. I'm working to spend it. You save, I spend. So, you know, that was what my money's for. So he gives me I call it my allowance. He says it's grocery allowance. I get my allowance, and I got my Social Security, and it's in my own checking account. I took care of my own car because we would argue over cars. He would buy the car that he thought I'd have. Of course, I made my own payments. Well, it wouldn't be something I liked, so I just started buying my own cars. So we have his and her cars, and then, you know, it just worked out better. His and her territory, his and her TVs, because we never liked the same shows, you know. And so we just, and yet there's a few things we liked together. That's still good. We're not too old, you know. And so, you know, it's just that anything that we got in controversy, or we tried to figure out how we wanted to do it. He pays the utilities, which that's about all we owe for now, phone bill. And if I make long-distance calls and I want to talk longer, I just give him the money for it. Here, that's for my phone call, $3. You know, I can talk all I want to. I don't feel guilty about it. And so everything's just working out pretty good for us. In fact, like I say, I never dreamed. In fact, we both didn't talk about it. Did you ever think that when you got old, and, you know, we're supposedly old, that things could be this wonderful, that you feel this good? You know, you don't have stress. When you have peace of mind and serenity, you don't have stress. When you don't have stress, you have better physical condition. Charlie had this heart attack several years ago and scared us all to death. And, you know, they're going to have surgery. The doctor told him certain things to do and the medication, and he started doing it, and he quit smoking. And you know, the last time they went in, they thought they were going to have to do one of these things where they open up all your the valves and veins and things. They went there, and most of it had cleared up because he'd been doing what he's supposed to do. Of course, when he had that heart attack, we had to sell all the cattle, and it gave him more time to do stuff in AA. You know, God does not do nor allow to be done what you yourself wouldn't do if you knew the end result. You know, today at my age and our age, we kind of seen some of the end results of all these things we've been doing. When they first told me that, I thought, hey, or God doesn't shut one door, but he'll open another one. I thought, okay, but let me peek. You know. Or have you ever read a book and it's getting, oh, I want to see how it ends. Yeah. You know, every once in a while, I don't want to read all this in between. It's getting too boring. Just let me see how it ends. Well, that's kind of like, you know, but that's not the way this book works. How would you learn faith? You know, if you already knew the end result. So you just have to know that God's going to take care of it. It may not be the way I want it to be. That was my greatest fear, is I want it my way. You know, that may not be the way it's supposed to be. I never would have asked God to give me an alcoholic and let me go through those 3 or 4 years of all that hell. That was not my, you know, one of my prayers and dreams. But I, you know, who would have known it was going to bring this? And who would have known I'd be standing here in Santa Barbara, California? You know, it's wonderful. And you know, that's why I say, you know, alcohol is not bad. What man does with it is bad. If it brought us this way of life, if it brought a higher power to Charlie, thank goodness he started drinking because he needed something. You know? And I certainly did. I couldn't get here with drinking, so God said, that poor woman, she's crazy. We got to get her with something. So, you know, and I always have to pass this on. I know when I first came, we talk about God a lot. Oh, my goodness, what am I doing? It's, you know, it's religion. And I have my own church that I go to some. But anyway, I read somewhere it says religion is a way to worship. And newcomers think we're telling them we can't talk about, you know, we don't want to talk about your religion. I think we're saying you can't talk about God. And we say, but religion is a way to worship. And spirituality is a way to live. And so that's what we've got, a spiritual program that teaches us how to live. So anyway, today, thank you, AA, for getting my husband into this wonderful fellowship and making me eligible for Al-Anon.